Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 5th, 2009, and this is show number 212. Man, how we get to 212? Didn't we do 200 just a few minutes ago? Time flies when you're having fun, I guess. Well, let's see. First thing we got to do here, I think we probably need some closure on the whole iPhone not being fixed because replacements are a different part number issue. So, to recap the very beginning of the story, I bought the brand new iPhone 3GS on the first day, and 6 days later it failed. The screen failed on it. You know, stuff happens, no big deal. You take it back, it shouldn't be a problem. Well, I took it back to Apple and they said, no problem, we'll replace that, but we don't have any replacement iPhones in stock. They said this while they're selling iPhones right next to me, the identical iPhones that I want them to give me, but they couldn't give me because they said it was a different part number. Well, bottom line, three visits to Apple, working three separate managers, talking to 16 separate representatives on the phone, including seven from AT&T, escalation to corporate at Apple. It only took me 6 days to get my brand new failed iPhone replaced. I want to be really clear here. I believe that every single person I talked to actually would have fixed this problem for me if they had had it in their power to do it. I really, really believe that Renee at my local store would have fixed it. I think she would have written a check with her own money shortly if I hadn't gotten taken care of, because she just didn't have the ability to override these stupid systems they had set up. In the end, I actually came up with a solution. See, they never did get any replacement iPhones in stock. Not ever. Not in the whole time I was waiting. So I was on the phone with the corporate guy, and he said, well, you know, we can ship one to your house. And I said, well, gee, you know, that's great. So you know what that means? That means I have to go to they're going to deliver it during the day. And of course, FedEx is not going to leave it on my doorstep because it's worth $700. So they're not going to leave it for me. So they're going to send it over to the FedEx facility, which is in a creepy warehouse part of town that I can't go to until after dark because they won't deliver it there until after dark because it'll still be on the truck all day. Then I get the new iPhone, then guess what? That also means I get to go to the post office too to deliver the old one back to you. So you've come up with the least convenient way for me to possibly get my iPhone. So we went around and around trying to figure out some way around this, and finally I had the idea. I said, how about you ship the replacement iPhone to the Apple store, FedEx it to the Apple store, make it attention my name and the manager's name, and then I'll just go over to the Apple store. I can go there from 10 in the morning to 10 at night. I walk up, you hand me the new iPhone, I hand in the old iPhone, and you guys have to ship it back. Perfect solution, right? So as I told the guy, I said, you know that if I do that, the day I do this, they're going to get replacement iPhones in the store. And he said, yes, but you also know that if you don't do this, they'll never get replacement iPhones in the store. And I said, yeah, well, you got me there. So they shipped the iPhone out that day. It came in on Thursday. I walked in on Thursday, swapped it out. But strange enough, I should back up a little bit. Before I got the call saying that the phone was there, I got a call from another manager at the Apple store, a woman named Heather, saying that she had a solution for me. Well, it turns out she, and I forget the other gentleman's name, the other manager, the two of them had put their heads together and they had figured out a way to override all of the systems Apple had in place to keep them from doing what I needed them to do. They had a way to basically manually override every policy they had, and they were prepared to execute it for me on that day. Of course, I told her, yeah, but I just checked FedEx and it says my phone just showed up in your store. And so she said, okay, well, all right, I guess we don't have to be creative. But finally, they had been creative, and I'm glad they did that because, like Bart said, that's what the next person needs, right, when this happens again. Now, another thing occurred to me in the middle of all of this. One of the things I kept stomping my foot about was, you know, I've been an Apple fanboy since 1984, and I've bought 14,000 Macs from you and bought four in the last 6 months and blah, 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 blah. They don't actually have to treat me nice because I'm going to keep coming back, right? I am the person they don't have to do anything for. I mean, those fanboys of us that stand in line on that first day, as long as they keep making killer hardware that we can't live without, we're just going to keep doing it. But I did point out to the guy, what if this were my first experience with Apple? Would I be in line over at that Sprint store for that little tiny pre really quick? I would have been out of there in a heartbeat. I would have thrown it back at them and said, give me my money back. So anyway, the bottom line is I do believe all of the people took care of me as best they could, but Apple had some really stupid processes in place. The good news is I have my iPhone 3GS in my hand. And I think I appreciate it even more now because I didn't I had it for a little while and then I lost it and had to go back to the old iPhone and got to go forward again to the newest one. And it's really, really fun. So enough about that. Let's get going. Well, Steve ran into a friend of his and discovered that he's a huge fan of the show. So I wanted to give a big shout out to Ray. Ray actually has saved all of the episodes from day one. How fun is that? You know, it's funny. I'm not surprised when I meet random people on the internet who listen to the show, but I am amazed when I meet people in real life who listen to the show. That just somehow seems weird. Kind of funny, though. Anyway, nice to have you listening, Ray. Just wanted to give a little shout out there.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
Good one.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, last week, Ken asked for a utility that would keep his desktop icons in place when he changes screen resolution, like when he attaches an external monitor. Well, Mark McCoy, who is, he calls himself longtime listener, first-time caller, he had a thought on how to get Ken's icons to stay put. He suggested setting up another user account that allowed him to operate his Mac with two completely separate identities, one for regular use and one for his altered monitor resolution use. He wasn't sure that would really work or whether that would be too much, too cumbersome, but Ken wrote back and said he tested it and that actually worked pretty well. I got an email, though, from Nancy that really takes it up a notch. I think she came up with the exact perfect solution. Here's what she wrote. Allison, strangely enough, I just ran into the same problem today right before I listened to your podcast. I found a piece of software called Desktility, that's like desk and tility without the U, Desktility, that solves the problem. I'm not sure it's worth $13 to me, but maybe it will be to Ken. Find it at desktility.com. Now, I know I've said it before, but I got to keep saying it. I love the new Silicast community. First, we have Mark over here helping him, and now we got Nancy. She's got the perfect solution to Ken's problem. Everybody helping each other. Well, I downloaded Desktility to see if it really did what she said, and I popped open the preferences, and right there it says, automatically restore icons after resolution change. It's almost like they actually wrote this utility with Ken in mind. I'm betting $13 is well worth it for Ken, but I'm thinking I might really like it because it's just so irritating when you can't find something on your desktop because it moved. Heck, you know where I'd really like it? On my Windows machine. I find navigating Windows so darn annoying. I put folders on my desktop so they're faster to drill down to, but darn things keep moving around on me. Even if I haven't changed resolution, I haven't attached a monitor, they seem to move all by themselves, so they're practically useless on the desktop. Then I looked at Desktility a little bit closer, and guess what? Desktility runs on Windows, too. Hot dogs! I'm definitely checking that out and seeing how it works on Windows. Thank you, Nancy, for solving Ken's problem and my problem with Desktility. Well, Ed Vogt wrote in with a quick little tip about iPhone 3.0 software that he thought you guys might be interested in as well as me. Here's what he wrote. Hello, Allison. Thanks for a great podcast. You're welcome, Ed. I discovered a feature in 3.0 today that I haven't heard of before, and I thought you could let your listeners know. I have a smart playlist in iTunes that I sync to my phone that contains only podcasts that have not been played. Today I noticed that after I listen to it, it's deleted, and when I download one over the air on my iPhone, it gets added to the playlist. So I guess smart playlists continue to function on the iPhone getting over-the-air podcasts. Keep up the great work. Edward Vogt. Well, that's really pretty cool. I've never quite gotten the hang of the whole unplayed episodes playlist thing myself. I try to do it, and I think it does what it's supposed to do, but I still get a little confused on what episodes I've listened to. Now, it could be a contributing factor that I use an iPod mini in my car, I walk around with the iPod Nano with the lanyard headphones, and then I use the iPhone just occasionally for podcasts, and of course, I watch video podcasts on my Mac when I'm not watching them on my iPhone. Well, maybe that's why I'm confused as to what I've heard. Anyway, thanks for the tip, Edward. I'm sure someone more organized than I am will be able to use this tip. Well, Josh wrote in with another Twitter client. You know, we need more of those, right? I mean, my plan is just to use a new one every week so I can never figure out where any of the menus are. Hey, but seriously, this one has a new angle that I think would be very useful. Hi, Allison. I wanted to tell you about this amazing and easy Twitter client. You might not call it a client. It's called Twitbin. It lets you access Twitter from any site you're on. This is an add-on for Firefox that is so easy to use. I really only got it an hour ago, so I don't have a review on it, but I'm already loving it. Here's a link to where you can get the add-on at addons.mozilla.org. It opens up a page on how to set it up the first time, which is really useful. Well, I got to tell you, this is totally stinking cool, Josh. I love it. I loaded it up on my Mac first and then on my Windows machine, running Firefox, and I loved it immediately. Now, it is missing two things I really like. It doesn't have groups, which a lot of clients don't have, and it doesn't have a way to see the shortened URLs, which I'd really like it to do for security. But, and I don't know, maybe I'm addicted to trying Twitter clients out, but I really like Twitbin. I like the idea of not having to launch another application, just having Twitter waiting for me in the sidebar of the browser. Now, the Twitbin developers have an odd implementation of how to do short URLs. Instead of a dedicated button that brings up a field to paste in a long URL, or you paste it in first and hit a button to shorten it, you actually go to the page you want to shorten and then right-click anywhere on the page, and at the bottom of the contextual menu, it says, "Tweet this." Now, that doesn't do you much good if you copied the URL from somewhere else, but I guess this method would probably work in a lot of instances. I hope everybody wants to go check it out. I think it's very, very slick. By the way, you can follow Josh on Twitter at twitter.com/FCLinux001. In fact, I believe Josh is actually in the chat room of the live show right now, which I haven't mentioned in a while. You can always join the live show at ustream.tv/nosillacast at 5 p.m. GMT-8, which is also known as Pacific time, on Sunday nights. Anyway, let me keep going because Josh, at the end of his email, added a little postscript. He said, "I know you don't like PowerPoint, so try OpenOffice.org's Impress instead." Well, as I told Josh, I load OpenOffice up pretty quickly on pretty much every machine and every virtual machine I get, but it does not solve the problem I have with PowerPoint. See, PowerPoint is badly written, but it's an awful piece of software, but that's not really why I complain so much about it. The problem I see is that we take everything we want to say to people and we spend all this effort and time trying to squash it into an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper. Why do we do that? Why does it have to be 8.5 by 11? Why must there be bullets? We spend at least 50% of our time trying to get the font to stay still, make the indents look right, and get all the info onto the one page without covering up the little page number down in the bottom right, right? That only leaves you half of your time to be creative and figuring out what it is you want to say. You know, I had a big presentation to do last week, and I just hung my head at the thought that I actually had to go use PowerPoint. I was so sad, but what was I supposed to do? And then suddenly I realized it was completely unnecessary. All I did was I went over to a wiki and I started to write. I banged out my presentation in about an hour, moving seamlessly between ideas with no artificial breakpoints for pages. I could move my ideas around, delete sections, paste in graphics, all without a single worry about formatting. I do confess I put things in some kind of bulleted form, but the bullets were all easy. I didn't have any little rulers to drag around anything. You just do a bullet or you do two bullets to make it go over to indent one. It was perfectly easy. When I was done, I simply showed the wiki on screen and scrolled my way through it as I did my presentation. Now, some people say, well, you know, they're going to read ahead. They're going to read the next page if you do that. You want to keep them from reading that. But, you know, so what? If I'm not feeding them information fast enough, isn't that my problem? When I was finished, the wiki I was using had a beautiful little button that said print to PDF. I pressed print to PDF and I handed everyone a hard copy that was nicely formatted and looked like a formal report. Now, not every wiki does have that option. It was the wiki called Confluence, and I got to tell you, it came out gorgeous, looked really good for the people who like paper. Not a big fan of paper myself, but a lot of people like it. So I gotta mention, though, another thing was this presentation. I had to collaborate with some other people. So I showed this presentation to probably 20 people over the course of a week, getting it ready for the big dog I needed to present it to. By the time I got it to her, everybody had done their own collaboration on it. People could type into it. They could type comments. They could edit. They could, you know, add information that I didn't have. So I did a collaborative job instead of it being shoved into an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Bottom line is, I think we need to challenge this brain freeze we all have on ourselves that we have to think in that rectangular place to think. What happened to just thinking? I tell you, it's even being taught in our elementary schools. My niece had to do a PowerPoint presentation in second grade. I find that appalling. We take these young creative minds and tell them they have to type in a rectangle. You know, that's simply nuts. I know this is an uphill battle, but if you think about it, it's really like this vestigial artifact of the days of overhead projectors with clear, flexible film sitting on top of it. Why do we force ourselves to live in that box anymore? The next time you're trying to get some ideas across to a group of people, try not using PowerPoint, not using Impress, not even using Keynote. Just create your thoughts in a wiki or heck, just talk to them and hand them a document at the end if they need it. I'm serious about this. Break out of that mold. All right, I'm off my soapbox. Are you a helpful person? Do you find people come to you for geek help? Do you find that you answer the same questions over and over again? Do you like to take screen snapshots to accompany your instructions you mail to your friends and family who suck the life out of you with their incessant questions? Do you like to annotate your screenshots so that they can't possibly miss the button you've told them 26 times on the phone to click? Well, why don't you make your life easier and just buy ScreenSteps? With ScreenSteps, you can rapidly take screenshots, even pull down menus you can take screenshots, annotate them with giant sarcastic arrows or subtle step numbers, throw in some words to more patiently say what you've been yelling into the phone to them, even put in links so they can't possibly mistype the URL like they did the last time and the time before that and the time before that. Publish the instructions as a PDF file and mail it to them so they can print it out and keep it right there by their computer. Better yet, post it as an HTML document on your blog so you can just point them to the URL over and over and over again as they ask the same question. ScreenSteps is the most happy-making software I have on my Mac and PC because I get to play with an intuitive tool, get people off my back, and they think I'm a big old hero because they presume I went to a ton of work to make the documentation for them. Make yourself happy. Go to ScreenSteps.com. Buy ScreenSteps for 25% off using the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, and get back to enjoying your life. Back in January, when I was at Macworld Expo, my head flipped 90 degrees and snapped to look at something really, really cool, and I've been begging for a review unit for a long time and finally got it. It was the Ecamm Bluetooth HD camera. It's a tiny little pocket-sized webcam, and by pocket size, I mean maybe half the size of a deck of cards, about the same thickness but half as long. And you connect it via Bluetooth for video chat and other kinds of operations. So in size, it's only 2 by 2.5 by 0.625 inches thick, and it weighs nothing, you know, nothing at all. It provides 640 by 480 H.264 video and 48 kilohertz AAC audio. Now, I think calling this a high-def camera is not quite technically right, because HD is either 720p or 1080p. This is 640 by 480 for the BT1, so that's technically VGA. Not sure why they claimed it was HD, but I think maybe they thought using the H.264 codec made it high def. But let's skip past that and see how this puppy works. The first thing you need to do is download the software. I'm kind of glad they didn't bother shipping an outdated CD with it, which would have made the box twice as big as necessary. So a straight download is actually a much better idea. So once I had the software downloaded, it put an icon in my menu bar so I could choose it to connect to the camera. I launched iChat and whipped open the preferences, and there was the camera in the list. I then decided to bother my friend Tim of Butterfly Poop fame and made him chat with me. The camera worked just fine. Worked perfectly. I also tested it with Kyle and flipped between my display eyesight camera, the camera built into the 24-inch Apple display that I have, and the video quality of the BT1 looked almost as good, perhaps a smidge less sharp. Now, you might be thinking, what problem does this solve, since we pretty much have cameras in all the Macs now and lots of portable options for PCs, so why do we need the BT1? Well, since the BT1 is Bluetooth, you can put it up to 30 feet away from your computer, facing any direction. How many times have you packed three people around your laptop, all jammed together, trying to get into a video chat? Now, with the BT1 and its tiny little included tripod, it's really cute, it's got these three little stubby legs, you can put the camera anywhere you like. Heck, I pointed it at my TV so Tim could watch a movie when I was talking to him. Okay, that's a dumb idea, but you get the point. Maybe I could have pointed it at Wimbledon today when Jane from Perth, Australia, was trying to find it on her TV and couldn't get it. I could have played it for her. Well, speaking of the tripod, the BT1 uses a standard tripod mounting screw, so you can put it on any tripod or monopod, or you can just use the cute little tabletop one. The tripod it comes with has a ball joint right below the mount, so you can easily adjust the angle of the BT1, and the three little stubby legs are maybe 2 inches long. Now, I put a picture in the show notes from the Ecamm website, but it makes the whole setup look huge. The way they did the perspective, it looks like it's as tall as a MacBook, but it is only about 6 inches tall when it's sitting on its little legs. One thing that threw me for a loop, and I wrote to Glenn over at Ecamm Network to see what I was missing, to try to understand what was wrong. My confusion was that I couldn't figure out how to turn off the BT1. It has a little power button on the back, but no matter how long or short or how often I pushed it, the darn thing wouldn't turn off. Well, it's very clever, actually. Glenn explained that if you have an application talking to the BT1, it won't let you shut it off. As soon as I quit my application, all I had to do was hold down the power on the BT1 for a few seconds, and off it went. I should mention, let me talk a little bit more about the quality of the picture. I found that the BT1 had pretty good color, but the image was perhaps a bit soft, like I said. Now, I judged it against the built-in EyeSight camera on the new MacBook Pro, taking the same picture with both cameras. On the other hand, now that I studied it a little bit more, the BT1 actually gives more depth of color and so more detail. For example, I had on a jet black shirt, and the EyeSight pretty much showed pure black. But the BT1 shows varying shades of dark gray to black. Sort of like it looked in real life. Likewise, with my hair, it shows the different colors of brown on the BT1, while the EyeSight shows my hair is almost all the same color, almost black. I suppose there's a technical term for the lack of color variation on the EyeSight. Maybe the black point is too high? Anyway, in looking at them closely, I think I prefer the BT1 image, even though it's not quite as crisp. Check out the images I put in the show notes and judge for yourself. Now, I know I got a lot of flack about my comparison of the pictures I took with the iPhone Storm and G1, Bart, so I expect I'll get flack on my lack of judgment here, too. It's all part of the job. The BT1 charges via an included USB cable, and they promise 4 hours of talk time. Now, I couldn't get anyone to agree to talk to me for 4 hours on chat, so I can't test that part out. The BT1 will run you $150, which is pretty standard for good quality webcams, so I think it's a very fair price, especially considering that you get the extra flexibility of Bluetooth. You also know you're dealing with a good company with Ecamm Network. They make the Huckleberry that the Mac mommy loves, and PhoneView, which lets you store data on your iPhone, which many of us receive through the Mac Heist bundle, and the long-appreciated eyeglasses software that gives you added flexibility with your EyeSight camera. If you need or just want a Bluetooth webcam, check out the BT1 at bt-1.com, or you can find it on the Ecamm Network website at ecamm.com. Well, we're still going on our audio testimonial tour from Honda Bob's fans at his 30-year anniversary picnic. This is one of my favorites.
I can project.
There he goes. All right, you've already heard from Michael Fried there. I noticed he was kind of a smart aleck, so I thought he'd be good up next on our interview of Honda Bob customers. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day here in Long Beach.
So how long you known Honda Bob?
I think it's about 3 years now.
And what do you think? Kind of a deadbeat? What's the story here?
Honda Bob is a great guy, and he just loves taking care of people and Hondas. I'm not sure which order. I think he likes taking care of Hondas first, but he takes care of people, too.
Yeah, you really do feel safe with him, don't you?
Yeah, he's a great guy. He knows what he's doing, and he does it. He comes when he says he's going to come. He fixes what he says he's going to fix, and he does a great job for everybody, I think.
I notice he even cleans up after himself.
Yep, pretty good. He's left a couple little things on the driveway when we're done, but I'd say 95% he cleans up after.
Not that a hose can't take care of, right? So what's the biggest repair you've had him do?
He changed out an engine for me. We lost an engine and found an engine, which for our car was kind of hard to do, but I found one, and he picked it up and put it in for us.
Wow, that was all in the driveway.
In the driveway, yeah. He's got his little trailer. and his engine cherry picker, and he comes in and grabbed the engine out of the car, took it with him back to his shop, got the rebuilt, or not rebuilt, got the used engine, put all my parts on it from our car that we knew worked, and came up, dropped it in the car, worked like a charm. That's
wow.
The car I drove here today.
And you never had to leave the comfort of your own home the whole time, right?
That's right. The car sat, and it was actually parked on the street for about a week, and, you know, it was easy. It wasn't fun. It wasn't cheap, but it was easy.
Well, that's the best you can hope for with car repair, right?
That's right. You know, he does a good job and is very reasonable.
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right.
Well, if Michael has convinced you that you'd like to have Honda Bob come to your house in the LA or Orange County area to work on your Honda or Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.E. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. And it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you on this happy 4th of July?
Well, happy 4th of July to you. It's not really that big of a deal over here, strangely enough.
Well, I did point out to Steve that it is 4th of July in Ireland as well.
Yeah, it's just not a holiday. Just a day.
Very interesting. Well, we're so out of it. We went to the beach this morning for our normal Saturday morning run, and we're trying to figure out why there's all these cars down there. And we're like, oh, man, is there a race on the beach? Why is everybody... Oh, it's 4th of July.
Why would they be on the beach?
Oh, that's where everybody goes, is to the beach. And everybody's doing barbecues and got there, and they're doing playing volleyball, and they're drunk already. I mean, seriously, people like
the time you go for your morning run.
Yeah, it's like 8 a.m. and they're hammered. I mean, Steve saw a bunch of guys on bikes singing the Star Spangled Banner at the top of their lungs, clearly inebriated. I saw a whole bunch of guys just sitting around drinking beer. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to get ugly later.
But what are they doing barbecuing? Like, are they barbecuing bacon and eggs or something?
No, you have to go squat your land down there. You need to get your area set aside because it gets crowded later.
But there's hundreds and hundreds of miles of coastline.
Yeah, but you want to be where you told everybody to show up. So, and there's hundreds of millions of people. So, it's a popular place.
I see.
All right. So your sound continues to sound fantastic, Bart.
I think you'll find that should sound fantastic-er, or more fantastic, depending on what we want to phrase that.
And tell the audience why that might be.
Well, because Alison quite kindly noticed that I had my microphone pointed the wrong way. Because this, unlike every other microphone I've ever used in my life, you don't talk into this when you talk sideways at it.
Right, so not into the top of it, but into the side. So this is a pet peeve of mine when I watch the show Frasier, because Roz has a microphone, the kind you're supposed to speak into the end, but she speaks into the side of it. And I keep wanting to go, ah, you guys got that wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
but yeah, so I thought I had a mic like... Rush Limbaugh, who clearly shouts at the front of his gold-plated mic, whereas in actual fact, I had a mic like Dave Letterman, who talks into the side of it.
There we go. Well, it does sound lovely, I think.
Excellent.
All right, so have we got any security light this week?
Not that meets the rules. We have security heavy. There is a nasty flaw in the iPhone at the moment, but Apple are working on it. But it's still pretty nasty. And there's absolutely nothing we can do to protect ourselves. So just hang in there. As soon as Apple release an update, jump on it.
So we just we won't talk about it because we have no solution. So good. Let's see. We're both enamored with a product called an application called Mac Tracker, and you found an extra cool use for it. Why don't you tell people what Mac Tracker actually is first?
Well, it's an app that tells you lots and lots of information about every Mac ever made. And I'm just going to backtrack a little how okay. I ended up talking about this. A couple of weeks back, I talked about getting my new to me iMac and how it was quite noisy, and then. Someone called Crazy Listener Kate, according to you, Allison?
Yes. Oh, yeah. She could be Crazy Listener James' evil twin sister, I think.
Anyway, she very kindly and very nicely sent in an email suggesting installing newer versions of firmware, perhaps, and also trying to vacuum clean the vents, which is a genius idea, so we'll definitely give that a go. Hmm. But then I sort of started thinking, well, what versions of firmware are there available for this Mac? And we started off by just searching the Apple site, but to be honest, Apple don't make that particularly easy because they don't really care.
Like, yeah, they really don't.
If you search for iMac, you'll get every iMac ever in existence. So there's no real easy way. There's no sort of homepage for my model of iMac that I can just go to and get everything.
And they don't clearly come through a software update, right? They may sometimes, but not clearly every time?
Yeah, any firmware update I've ever installed on my MacBook Pro has just come through software update. So the fact that software update thought that there was no need for one from my iMac made me think there probably wasn't. But I wasn't, you know, I still wanted to check into it a bit more. So searching the Apple site didn't reveal anything. But then I decided to have a look on Mac Tracker, which said that there were no firmware updates available for this model of iMac. So that sounded good. Then to make dead sure that Mac Tracker would cover such things, if there were such things available, I looked up my MacBook Pro and it said that there were two updates available, which is also correct.
So explain what Mac Tracker is.
Okay, so it's basically an app that is, I suppose you could call it a database of everything Apple have ever made. And it even, I think, includes the one digital camera Apple once made. It includes every model of Newton and includes every model of, I think they were called laser writers when Apple still made printers. Every model of cinema display, every version of OS, everything. all the classic OSs and OS X. And, of course, every Mac and every Xserve and everything. iPods, everything's in there, I think.
iPods are in there. Oh, yeah. I just noticed they've even added a thing called the timeline, so you can look by year to see which ones were out in what years.
Yeah, that's always been there, I thought.
Models? No. No, ages ago it wasn't. Well, I've been using Mac Tracker for as far back as I can possibly remember.
I've been using it for quite a few years, and I remember that timeline being there for quite some time. But the nice thing is there's also a link to this Mac, which is always dead handy.
This Mac? What do you mean?
Well, if you run the full version of the desktop,
yeah,
there's a shortcut called this Mac. So if you're wondering exactly which model of Mac you have, just run it on the Mac in question. It'll just tell you.
Oh, that's kind
of
cool.
And then you can find out all sorts of wonderful things. Like, let me see. My Mac was introduced in October 2005. It was discontinued in March 2006. Its machine ID is PowerMac12,1. Even the order numbers that they started with. The processor is a PowerPC 970FXG5, number of cores 1, 2.1 gigahertz.
Just about anything you'd want to know.
Yeah, and that's only in the general tab. Then you also have memory graphics tab, which tells me that it came with a half a gig of RAM and can go to a maximum of 2.5 gigs. I can still go a little higher because I'm only at 1.5 gigs.
You can even hear the startup chime of every old Mac. Yeah, that's kind of fun to go back.
I don't know if the mic picked that up, but that was startup chime of my iMac, which isn't all that interesting. See, that's only fun in the really old models where they had different chimes. And on some of the really, really old models, they even have the crash chime.
That's cool. Oh, they've got the old EyeSight cameras in there. That's pretty cool.
Everything in there.
Yeah. It's free. It's freeware, by the way.
It is freeware?
Yeah, it's freeware, but I have donated twice because I've used it for, like I said, I don't know, 10, 15 years. So I figured, every 5 years or so, I ought to pay him some money. So I just kept giving him money because in the development of this thing, I mean, it just keeps getting more and more advanced. It's from MacTracker.DreamHosters.com.
It even actually allows you to make notes and comments. So if you were to work in a large IT organization, you can actually add in how many of each model you have. And some notes and comments on them. So you can use it to keep track of your Macs.
Well, you could just if you'd like to be able to go back and see what you've owned. I just noticed they've got my models. So you've got in warranty, leaving warranty, and out of warranty.
Yep.
And one thing I would have liked to have been able to do would be to drag from, like I hit this Mac and it shows me which one it is. I'd like to be able to just drag that into my models, but it doesn't let you do that. That would have been kind of cool.
No, it's really quite cool. And there's also an iPhone version, which is handy.
Yeah, I haven't played with that yet. Now, one thing I was disappointed by, they used to have, if you went to MacTracker.com, you could get, on your iPhone, you got an iPhone version of it. And it turns out it went to a specific URL, and I caught that URL, and I gave it over to Slough to show him that it was an accessible version. It was much easier for him to read. And so I thought, wow, that's really great. And then they discontinued that page. I was very disappointed in that.
Yeah, they were one of the few people to take Steve Jobs up on his completely bogus offer that, well, if you just design a web page, that's just as good as writing an iPhone app, isn't it?
But it was good. It had great value, right?
Yeah, but when they had the ability to write a real app, they went for that instead and they discontinued the web app. It might have been nice if they'd kept the web app, but I'm certainly not sorry that they actually wrote a real iPhone app. Because the big problem with the web-based one is, particularly iPod Touch owners, if you're not on the network, you know nothing.
Yeah, that's true. But what I liked about it, I liked using it just from the Mac. I mean, so if I was on a Windows machine, for example, I'm at work and I wanted to look up a Mac model, I could go to, I don't know what it was, m.mactracker.com or something like that. And then I could look at it, and it flipped back and forth, but it flipped just like on the real app. It was really, really slid around nice. I really liked it.
No, but it was nice. It was very nicely done. It was one of the few examples of a good web app written for the iPhone.
Yeah.
But I still have to say I'm happy to now have it physically on my iPhone, so I'm not dependent on network to know the details.
Yeah.
Having said that, I don't actually think it's as good, the version, the iPhone version. For example, the icons are all of a really, really, really old Mac, so you can't really tell by looking at the picture what it is. Now, I think mine's an iMac G5 20-inch iSight. Mod 12.1. And I'm finding less information, I think, when I look through in this version, because I'm not seeing anything about firmware in the iPhone version, and it's definitely there in the desktop version.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so when you open open one of the models, at the very bottom it says firmware update, and it's actually got a link to it, so you can bang right into that. Look at that.
Yeah, but that is not... I cannot find that anywhere in the iPhone app.
Make sure you're looking for one that actually has it. So like MacBook Air, the MacBook Air has a firmware update, but like I looked at MacBook Pro for my model, and it doesn't have one. So
my MacBook Pro has two, so let's have a look at that.
Yeah, just make sure you're looking at the right one, or one that has it.
Oops, that's not a MacBook Pro, that's a Mac Pro, not the same thing.
slightly different. Oh man,
They're sorted by desktops, notebooks, etc. So MacBook Pro.
Oh, now this is interesting. The Apple TV has a firmware update I just heard about on SurfBits, and it's not showing in here. Maybe I need to update my application. You do need to run the application.
Yeah, no, I'm not seeing it here on my MacBook Pro either, and it definitely has updates. And the desktop app tells me about the updates, whereas the iPhone app does not.
Interesting. Okay. Well, it's partway there. That's good.
Yeah, and it still plays the startup chimes.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's really important. All right. Well, that's a nice little hot tip, I think. It's probably an application most people know about, but it's nice to go back and revisit because it's pretty useful stuff.
It is exceptionally useful. I use it a lot in work as well.
Well, let's get into the real meat.
This is kind of cool. There's actually a Windows version.
Is there really?
There is a Windows version, which our techs in work use, because they're all Windows heads, but they do look after the Macs. So they have a version on their Windows laptops.
Oh, I'm so putting this on my machine when nobody's looking. That's awesome. Cool, hot tip.
Anyway, sorry to distract.
That's all right. So let's get to the real meat of the show. I believe this segment is called Why Bart Hates Facebook.
What seemed only fair after all the...
Flickr bashing?
Flickr bashing that we'd now turn the table. So this time you're defending Facebook and I'm saying why I hate it. I should probably give some backstory first. I've been avoiding joining Facebook for decades. Well, as long as it's existed, I've been avoiding it because I find the whole concept rather troubling. But my little brother is spending a year in Canada and he has made it clear that he is not sending individual emails to everyone and he is simply updating his Facebook. And if we care about him at all, we should go and join Facebook.
Yeah.
So I hummed and hawed for a while and I thought, well, okay, he's my little brother. And I do actually want to know how he's getting on in Canada because I'm not going to see him for a whole year. So I went and joined Facebook.
Well, now this is exactly how I got suckered in too, Bart, was when Lindsay went to Italy. I knew that the only way I would know what she was doing was if I went into Facebook. So I got trapped the same way.
Aha. That does explain it. Okay. So me with my security hat on, of course, has perhaps a different view of this than many people. But for me, this thing, I thought Google knew too much about me. Google know nothing. Nothing whatsoever compared to what Facebook know. Facebook knew more about me than Google did before I even joined Facebook.
How?
It knew my entire network of friends just from the people who tried to add me.
Okay.
As soon as I joined up, there were 50 waiting friend requests there that Facebook already knew who my friends were.
How did people request you before you were there? I did that?
Yes, you did.
How can you be requested if you don't have an account?
You know the way Facebook keeps on harassing you to give you the password to your email account? Which, by the way, if there is a single thing that is the most despicable thing I've ever seen online, that's it.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about. I've never had Facebook ask me for my email address.
It asked me about 50 times yesterday. It says, what's your email address and what's the password for that email address? And then it goes to your address book and invites everyone in your address book.
I've never had it do that, Bart. I don't know how you what you click to trigger it.
I skipped that step. I clicked skip on that about 10 times and it kept on telling me, no, you really do want to do that.
Yeah, no, I didn't have any intention of doing that.
And then it'd come back. And then it'd go somewhere else and it'd come back. Kept on trying to do it. Huh. And I can't overemphasize how evil a thing that is to do. Your entire online life revolves around your email address. Every service you sign up for, that is your verification. It's like your social security number online. If someone gets control of your email address, they own you online.
Well, not to mention you're invading the privacy of everyone in your address book, which I would never do. I have friends who do that all the time, by the way. It makes me nuts. They give my email address to the New York Times or something, you know, to send, send this message. And they do not understand why that irritates the daylights out of me.
Yeah, okay, well, this is bad on a number of levels. So the risk here is that you lose your entire online presence. Mm-hmm. Because every time you sign up for a site, it's your email address is what's used for the I forgot my password link. So if someone has control of your email address, they can change your password on everything and they can completely become you. And you can't get you back. You have lost your online identity.
Sure.
So by Facebook encouraging people to do this, they make it acceptable for this to be done. And then there's millions of non-legitimate services that do it. The amount of my friends who have been hacked this way is outrageous. And the amount of spam it generates, because you then get spammed when one of your contacts is, quite frankly, stupid enough to give out the password to their email address, basically hand out the keys to the kingdom. And then you have to explain to them. And it all comes back to the fact that they're all Facebook users and they're used to this. They think this is normal. And Facebook have a lot to answer for there. That is not acceptable.
That's a good point. Just even if you were to, say, decide you trusted Facebook, if that made you think you could trust everybody, that would be a very bad thing.
It's not
that I would trust it with Facebook.
I have a social security number. And we would scream and shout at Facebook for that. But for some reason, we don't when it comes to our email.
Right. I don't give mine out. I don't think I've ever given my email password to anybody anywhere ever. So... okay, well, I wonder why it kept pestering you. Maybe that's a new thing in when you sign up that it starts pestering you.
It's after it says, give me an email address, and I think it asks you for a few basic bits of information and a really difficult CAPTCHAs. All of their CAPTCHAs are evil, I just like to say.
Oh, now, actually, I did give them my email address, not my password, because that's how you get the notifications.
Well, your email address is like your user ID. They don't actually ask you for a username. They just ask you for an email address. That's fine. So step one is that really basics. And then step two is, give me the keys, give me the password
to your
email address,
which
you then skip. And then you get the list of all of the people who've already friended you before you even joined.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I have a bunch of notes here. Because I've covered that. What also scared me, actually, is that... so there's a bunch of people who friended him before he even started. Fair enough. Some of them were interesting. Saved me a teeny bit of typing.
I don't understand how that could be. You said I friended you before you started. How could we friend someone who doesn't have an account? You exist.
There was a friend request in from you, and I accepted it. You didn't have to accept one from me. And we are linked.
But how could that be? How did you exist in Facebook without... having an account created? That's like your name doesn't exist in any form in there.
My email address somehow was, there were waiting invites and you were one of them.
That is, I don't understand that. Okay. I'm not disbelieving you. I don't understand.
Then the next level then is, once you have accepted one or two people, it then goes through all of their friend lists and tries to figure out your mutual friends and gives you another 100 people or so. Almost all of which were people I actually knew. So the amount of stuff they knew about me before I had told them anything is staggering.
So that's just saying, if you had a friend and then that friend had other friends, they suggest those might be people you knew, right?
But they were doing something, some sort of filtering, because it wasn't that every person that any of my friends knew. They had obviously managed to do some sort of thing that if I know these two people and these two people know this one person, then the chances are I also know this one person. There was more going on than just this is all of your friends' friends.
Okay.
It was a much more tailored list and it was way accurate.
But that could only be done with just logic, right? It's not that knew. It's not that they knew that about you. It's that they figured that out about you. Right.
It
was possibly true.
They have on you.
Yeah.
Before you've done anything, before you've even given them anything, they already have a massive amount of information because of what everyone else has told them.
Okay.
So they know so much about you. It blew me away, actually. I was like, okay.
Okay.
Which, of course, immediately jumped me into the, right, I am going to the privacy settings right now. Mm-hmm. Which is what I did. And this is sort of the point where I think it is fundamentally flawed. And you've tried to help me out here a bit by setting up groups, but that didn't allow me to do what I want to do. Because I did that, and it did not help.
So explain what the problem is first. You jump to the answer. So the problem you see is...
Okay. So the problem I see is a fundamental design issue. Is that Facebook think the world can be divided into two groups of people. People who are my friends and people who aren't. That's not realistic. Because I want to have different levels of relationships with people who are my family, people who are my close friends, people who are just acquaintances.
Okay.
Maybe old college friends. I mean, there's at least three levels there that I can think of.
Okay.
Perhaps more. And even Flickr, as terrible as its interface is, gives you family and friends and contacts. That's three levels.
Okay, that's, you're just saying the built-in groups that it starts with. So the built-in groups are just, it's sort of, I think it's friends and friends of friends and everyone. Those are the only three categories to start with.
But I have now set up groups.
Okay.
And my basic information, the options I have are everyone, friends of friends, only friends, or customized. And I thought customized would let me narrow it down to my lists that I've created.
It can.
I have it here in front of me.
Okay, I'm looking at it, for example, if I look at personal info, I have only friends, and then I hit customize, so it says accept these people, and I put the podcast list. Or I can put the name of a specific person that I don't want to be able to see it, like Crazy Listener James, for example.
But that's utterly useless. If I want to have only my family see certain information, every time I add a new friend, I have to go in and remove them from the information? That's not workable.
Wait. Say that again one more time, slower.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to friend anyone who I happen to know. Mm-hmm. That way you have a link to them. That's the point of this exercise.
Right.
But I don't want those random people to have access to my IM account and that kind of thing.
Okay. So when you add people, when you accept them, there's a little pull down. So you say what group you want them to go in. Mm-hmm. And you declare that that group doesn't have access to certain things.
I can't do that. How do I do that? The only option I get here is it's either friends of friends, only friends, or people I exclude.
No. The other way around. So I think you're thinking about it backwards. So it says, so I'm on the personal info section, and I have friends of friends, only friends, and then I say accept these people. So I'm saying I want friends to be able to see my personal info unless they're in the list podcast. So that's everybody.
I want to say I want no one to see this except people in the group family.
Okay.
I shouldn't be. It's
backwards. You say because it's because you exclude people rather than add people. That's what bothers you.
Yeah, and because it's based off exclusion, you're constantly, every time you add someone else, you can't actually just set up simple.
Yeah, if you put the way you can get there, you're right. I see what you're saying. It's backwards of the way you want to do it. But the way you could do it is decide that your family are what's considered friends and everyone else fits into some other category that you're going to exclude. So as you add more people and they're not family members, you put them into one of those lists. And if that list is already excluded, then they'll never be able to get to that info and you don't have to do them one by one. It's backwards of what you want to do,
backwards.
Because you have very specific needs.
Well, no, but surely I don't think I'm as special in thinking that you want to limit your stuff based on how close your relationship is. I don't think I'm being unreasonable. I don't think I'm being
No, you're.
Silly.
I'm not think you're being. And I didn't say you're being unreasonable or silly, Bart. Don't get defensive.
I said
the way you want to get there is by saying I only want these people to be able to see it. The way they built it was excluding people from seeing it. It's just backwards of the way you want to do it, but it's just as workable. Hmm.
I would argue it's backwards and it's badly designed.
Fine, but you can do exactly what you want to do with this tool.
Except I have to set up a group called Not Family.
Sure, and put everybody in Not Family, except family, and their friends.
Yeah, but then it really is head-wrecking this way. It's not, I should be able to just do it by the following list of people. I trust the following list of people don't give this access to. I mean, it should be simple, but it's actually very complicated.
No, it's just backwards. It's not complicated. It's just the opposite of what you want to do. You have to exclude people rather than add people.
Okay, but what if I want to let family and close friends see one bit of information?
Okay, then...
then I have to have an inverse group called not family and close friends. But I want to let a different bit of information be seen by just family. Then I need another inverse group called not family, into which the close friends also have to.
Make your family be considered just generic friends. So you never have to talk about what they get to see, because they're going to be able to see it. And then you have close friends as a group, and then have, you know, people I added, but I don't really like. Those are your two categories, your two lists, right? So you go into, say, your personal info, you would exclude both of those two groups. But in, say, videos tagged view, you're only going to exclude the group people I don't really like.
It makes my head hurt.
Okay. Well, maybe you get used to it. I mean, there's a lot of Facebook I don't get and I don't understand, but I think I got a handle on this one finally.
There is one thing in their defense here, which is that at the very top, there is see how a friend sees your profile. So you can at least check that your terribly complicated setup actually works.
Well, where is that? Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's something. So you can put a few test cases in to make sure that you haven't warped your mind out of all
logic. Oh, that's
logic.
That's cool. So I can make sure crazy Lister James can't see hardly anything. Good, good, good. Okay.
You can verify that. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, to me, this shows that they've bolted on these protections as an afterthought. This isn't they designed this to be give everyone everything, and then as an afterthought, oh no, people are going to complain, rather than having designed it with security in mind.
Now, the one thing I really wanted to dig into here a little is, okay, the kind of information that I put up on Facebook is pictures, video, status, people write on my wall. I don't put up my home phone number. I don't put up my home address. I don't put up my social security number. I don't put up my bank account numbers. I don't put down addresses of people I know. What in there is dangerous for people to see?
Well, there's stuff. Hold on. I'm sorry. I'm just going to go into this. But there's a lot of stuff in here that I actually don't want to add because I don't think it's properly protected. I'm just going to go into profile.
And that's
here.
Your choice. You don't have. You can participate and have all the fun without putting in things that make you nervous.
But you see, if I was able to control things in an easier way, I wouldn't be so nervous about putting them in. Because I'm not adding in my IM details, because I just don't trust this whole inverted logic thing. It just hurts my head too much. It's like, okay, no, I'm just not going to put in any information. And that's not really right either. The other thing it keeps on wanting to know is stuff like my relationship statuses, whether I'm interested in men or women, my political views, my religious views. Some of this stuff, you know, I wouldn't mind sharing with family, but I'm not going to share it with everyone.
Yeah.
Contact information, as I say, the IM ones is a big one that I'd really like to share out with family, but I'm not going to because it's just too messy. And, you know, it'd be nice if my cousins, who I hardly ever see, actually got my IM address easily, but I'm not going to tell them. So I've ended up, the only contact information in there is my website. That's it. So I've ended up just not using it because they didn't design it well. So really, my wall has just been my Flickr stream and my blog sucked in. And the only contact information in there is my website, which anyone will find with Google. So actually, it's ended up not really being very useful to anyone who friends me.
Well, yeah. Let me ask, what worries you about putting your IM info in there?
I had trouble in the past with my IM information getting out to people I didn't want it to have.
Yeah.
And I don't give it out.
Yeah, I didn't put my IM information anyway either, but I did the opposite. What I did was I use Adium, as you do, and Adium can see your Facebook friends your Facebook friends who are online. So then that means you can chat with those people without ever giving them your IM. It's the best of both worlds.
Facebook chat, is it?
What's that? Yeah.
By using Facebook chat.
Right, right. And as long as you're not using Safari, that works. Safari's got some weird thing where it keeps disconnecting. But if you're using Firefox, it works great. So now I basically have a massive list of people I can bother and who can bother me.
Good. Yeah, well, of course I set up a Fluid app for Facebook, so it's out of the way. But of course that means it is running Safari.
Right. Oh, I see. Yeah, I've had trouble with that. I don't quite understand why, but yeah, it disconnects all the time.
Yeah. Anywho.
Anywho. So that might give you what you want, though.
Yeah, my next level of grumpiness was that the default search settings are too open. I didn't want to be that searchable by default.
So where do you change that?
Okay, so if you go to settings, privacy settings, it's one of the headings is search. Control who can search for you and what they can see.
Let me see. Search.
So the default was that they could see my friends, they could see my profile picture, and a bunch of other stuff. And I was like, I'm sorry.
That's a good one. Yeah, I think I'm going to take my friend list off. I'll link to add me as a friend. Yeah, I might just take off my friend list because that's sort of invading their privacy, right?
Yeah, but that's the default there. I think it's too open. I think that's a little... I don't think that's a fair default.
Yeah.
The other thing then that got me is this concept of Facebook ads, where they basically use you to pimp other people's stuff to your friends. So if you buy something, your friends then get an ad saying, Bart went and bought this set of headphones. So your name and your picture get used in a customized ad get directed at your friends.
I haven't ever seen that. That must mean that my friends do a lot of naughty stuff because I get really annoying ads.
Well, yeah, but it's unless you see their face in it, it isn't one of these ads. So it's tied into this whole beacon thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you buy something on a site that uses beacon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought they shut that. I thought that was a big controversy and they fixed that. I remember people going berserk about it.
Beacon is off by default, which is good because that's horrifically evil. But these ads aren't off by default. So if you do something through an app or something that allows Facebook to see that you've done something, they can then use you in an ad to your friends. And it's your picture. And Leo talked about this recently on probably Twit. I can't imagine it would have been on MacBreak Weekly. It must have been on Twit. Where his friends got an ad because he'd bought something. And it was his face saying, you know, Leo Laporte recommends X, Y, or Z. And he said he found that really disturbing. And I agree with him.
No, I haven't ever seen that. I wonder where I would look for those because I don't ever.
You can turn it off anyway, so I did.
So where is that? Is that again in settings?
It's again
application settings, maybe.
Privacy. It's either under applications or news feeds. Let me see.
Oh, probably applications.
Huh. It must be applications because it's not that one.
What other users can see via the Facebook platform?
Yeah, well, so if you go into applications, in you don't actually get any settings until you click over to settings, which is a little
That's a little annoying.
Beacon, where is it now? I can't find it now. It's here somewhere because I did find that and I turned it off.
Oh, okay. Well, you said beacon was off by default though, right?
Beacon is off by default, thank goodness.
That's good, but there's something else that's turned on.
Yeah. Then I also turned off Facebook Connect. I don't think that's appropriate to have on by default. I don't remember if it was on by default.
Oh, Facebook Connect. Let's see. It's a way to use applications outside of Facebook. Yeah.
Well, it says, don't allow friends to view my membership on other websites through Facebook Connect. And I think that's a very appropriate setting.
Oh, there it is. Right below that is Beacon Websites. That's where it's turned off. It's turned on. Don't allow Beacon Websites to... It's not off by default.
Off.
Yeah, it's not off by default.
Oh, it's not off by default?
No, it's not, because mine is not checked.
Oh. Well, now, I set up a new account. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. I'm just looking at my own notes, which say, Beacon is on by default - despicable. Comes up my view on that, actually, quite frankly. The other thing, then, is share my name, network, and list of friends the following information to applications. I just said, turn it off. Nothing through the Facebook API.
Yeah. I got to think what that would stop
from
happening.
There's another quote here in this section, which I pasted in, which says, word for word, when a friend of yours allows an application to access their information, that application may also access any information about you that your friend can already see. So whatever you give to a friend, your friend then has the right to pass on to anyone. No way to defend yourself from that. Bottom line, nothing of mine goes in.
Yeah. I don't see the danger of that. If you put information in there that you're nervous about being out, then yes, that would be a bad thing. But I just don't put information in that I'd be nervous having about.
But they go out, they're constantly begging you for more information. And then they're so lax with your information. So if you do what they ask you to do, you're completely hosed.
Okay. So why not leave that access on and don't put anything in you don't want shared?
Well, you don't have... That's not a choice. That's a fact.
No, no, no. Just don't put in but don't put in any information that you don't want out there.
Sure, I mean, but again, it completely defeats the purpose. And the fact that they dare to ask for this information and then just let your friends distribute it rather than let you control it, I find that really offensive.
Hmm. Yeah, oh, I agree. Reading that sentence did even give me a cold chill. But when I think about the information I have out there, like I said, I don't have my home address, my home phone number, my Social Security number, my bank account. I don't have anything in there that really scares me.
Which is good. So, but to be honest, I haven't even put in. They keep on asking me over and over again, what school did you go to? Sorry, none of your business. What company do you work for?
See,
definitely none of your business.
I don't have it asking me anything ever. I mean, once I set it up, I was done and it doesn't bother me. I wonder if there's a time period.
The amount of times I had to click skip this step before it would give me my homepage, and I would skip one step and it would then go back to a previous step I'd skipped before. It's like, Anna, come on, give me some more. Oh, go on. Okay, so you won't let me scan your email account. Tell me what school you went to. Click skip. So, can I scan your email account? Click skip. So, what school did you go to? It was driving me insane, and they were begging for information that was not appropriate for them.
Okay, so I'll be curious to see a month from now whether, I mean, find out whether it stops bothering you, because I, like I said, it doesn't ever ask me anything. I don't know.
Well, I don't even think they should be asking for some of the information out. They shouldn't be asking for your phone number if they also allow your friends to distribute your information. For there even to be a field there labeled phone number, and for this fact, that sentence to be true, is disgraceful. Hmm. They shouldn't even allow people enter that information if they're going to be so horribly lax with the information they have.
I see what you're saying. So what's funny to me is that you haven't complained about the things that actually do drive me bonkers, which is all the poking and throwing of fish and all those kinds of things.
To be honest, the homepage is so confusing. I have no idea what's going on. I don't know. I was going to say, could you explain what a wall is? Because everywhere I keep on getting emails about people's walls and my wall and... What?
Yeah, actually, the wall is kind of cool. So the wall is a public place for a conversation with you. So I can write on your wall and other people can comment on what I said. You can write on your own wall, but that's kind of considered not really something people really do. That's in poor taste.
Very first thing it asks you to do when you finally get to your homepage for the first time, do you want to write something on your wall?
Yeah, it's just kind of tacky. Other people write on your wall is the idea. So I could write on my wall, on your wall, happy birthday, Bart, if you were to put your birthday in. So I would be able to say happy birthday to you. And that's a big thing that happens. A lot of people, you can set it up where you can track when people's birthdays are. It shows up saying it's got, it shows up in your feed on the right-hand side when your birthday is. So I would be able to see that your birthday is coming up because you're a friend of mine. And so I could write happy birthday and other people could write happy birthday. You could write thanks. That's what happens on your wall.
You've just hit on something there. Birthday. One of the pieces of required information before they let you sign up is your full date of birth. Why? They insist on it. They will not let you not enter it. And I'd like to know exactly why they need to have information that's so critical to anyone trying to steal
because
my identity.
Because there's an age limit on when you can join. You're not allowed to be in it below, I think, 13 years old, something like that, for some reason.
I should have just lied in hindsight.
So anyway, that's what the wall is for. If you want to have a private conversation, if you look up in the top, there's a thing called inbox and you can compose new message. And that's just a private email between two people.
So like Flickr mail.
Okay. I've never seen Flickr mail show up. It must be one of those hidden double secret message things.
You also have an inbox in Flickr, which is right up there in the same place.
Okay. The other thing that's kind of strange but enjoyable in a weird way is wall-to-wall. So let's say I write happy birthday on your wall. You could click wall-to-wall, and you could say thank you, which shows up on my wall, but nobody can see what they can't see what the original message that you're replying to is, which is,
a good thing.
I don't know. It's fun.
That's what Bebo does, and that's what drives me completely potty. That's one of the reasons I hate Bebo. This concept that you have these completely disjointed... Actually, it's like Twitter. You have no idea what people are talking about.
Now, we haven't even talked about the reason I really like Facebook is the photos. So I can put up a set of photos that I took, say, at Kyle's graduation, and because I'm friends with friends of his, I'm direct friends with them. They've accepted me as a friend. I can tag them in the photos, and then they'll get a message telling them there's a photo of them. So it's a way of getting people to look at your photos, is if you tag them, they're going to know. And if someone comments on a photo that they were tagged in, they also get a message. So you get, that's where you get the social interaction that's kind of fun. Now, you don't like taking pictures of people, but that's what I like, taking pictures of people. I like taking pictures of my kids' friends, so it's really fun because then they get interactive. And, you know, otherwise, how do you make them sit through a slideshow of your photos? It's a much more fun way to see somebody's photos, too.
So you can choose to only look at the ones of you.
Or flip through them at the rate you want to flip through, instead of watching, you know, the 28 pictures of their kid walking up to the podium to receive an award or something, you know. But you can still participate and have fun with it and leave them comments that makes them feel good about their photos. So I think it's an ideal way to look at photos. I love it.
You see, the thing I might be interested in would be to share family photos.
Yeah.
Only I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it because there's no real easy way to have just family. So I actually won't be using it for that, because at our family events, there's always kids about, and I'm not going to post up pictures of other people's kids for...
Right, right. Well, but that's where you'd say exclude everybody but family.
Yeah. It feels so tacked on and backwards. It's like, oh, people seem to care about their privacy after all. Ooh, we'll have to tack something in here. It certainly wasn't designed from the ground up to be in any way sort of segmentable, or what's the correct word?
I just think it's backwards of the way you want it to be, but I think it is still segmented. But anyway, well, I guess I deserve this big on hate on because of all the ranting I've done about Flickr.
Yeah, well, as I say, we'll see how this goes. I'm going to see. Hopefully it lets me see what Steven's up to while he's away in Canada. But other than that, I don't know.
All right. Well, we better get going. We've been going on for quite a while here. Anything in the way of next week being fun?
I'm hoping next week could be fun, and I don't think there is anything in the way.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week, Mark.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Well, it looks like that's enough fun for this week. I don't want to go. I'm having too much fun. I'm having fun in the chat room. Having a good time. Well, I guess we better go, though. It's been going on for 1 hour and 6 minutes. And Steve gets mad at me if it goes on for too long. I even cut a piece out for next week. Anyway, keep up all the great emails and suggestions by sending them to allison@podfeet.com, and be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.